There is a fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space, and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. It lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Dimensions, the Twilight Zone podcast. On tonight's episode, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 17, titled 22. This episode was written by Rod Serling and Bennett Cerf, directed by Jack Smite, produced by Buck Houghton, music by Marius Constant, Jerry Goldsmith, Lucian Morawek, and Van Cleve. And in the cast were Barbara Nichols, Jonathan Harris, Fred Wayne, and Arlene Martell. Its original air date was February 10th of 1961, and you can watch this on Tubi TV, Freevee TV, Paramount Plus, and of course the Blu-rays and DVDs. Again, as always, I recommend the Blu-rays just for their crispness and clearness of quality and sound, and it's really not that expensive. If you have a little discretionary income or a little bit of extra side money, it never hurts to buy the DVD or to buy the Blu-rays. Buy the Blu-rays if you're looking to get into the physical media of it again, since apparently physical media is going away. You know, if you wanted the Blu-rays, now would be a great time to buy them. Now, as always, if you haven't seen this episode since it first aired, or you haven't seen it before, there will be spoilers ahead. So if you haven't seen it, pause this, go watch it, come back, listen to the rest of this episode, because it's a good one tonight, ladies and gentlemen. It's a good one tonight. So if you haven't seen this episode, by all means, go watch it. Spoilers ahead. And with that, let's get into the opening narration. This is Miss Liz Powell. She's a professional dancer, and she's in the hospital as a result of overwork and nervous fatigue. At this moment, we have just finished walking with her in a nightmare. In a moment, she'll wake up, and we'll remain by her side. The problem here is that both Miss Powell and you will reach a point where it might be difficult to decide which is reality and which is nightmare. A problem uncommon, perhaps, but rather peculiar to the Twilight Zone. So, we see Miss Liz Powell have a dream when we start the episode, where she wakes up, she hears a clock ticking loudly and louder and louder. She reaches for her glass of water. She knocks the water to the floor, breaking the glass, making a smashing sound. She then hears a nurse at the door. She gets up ever timidly, goes to the door, and follows the nurse down the hallway to the elevator. The nurse gets on the elevator. Liz gets on the next elevator. The nurse goes to the basement. Liz goes to the basement. Liz walks down the corridor to room 22, the morgue, where a striking woman with strong features opens the door, looks at her, and says, "Room for one more, honey." This causes Liz to run screaming in a panic and in terror, where she wakes up in the hospital bed, surrounded by her doctor and a nurse. And this pattern repeats itself for a number of nights. Now, Liz Powell is in the hospital for overwork and nervous fatigue, as Rod Serling points out. You could probably consider overwork and nervous fatigue to be a post-traumatic stress disorder way of saying shell shock to a person that had a nervous breakdown. So it seems like her mind sort of took leave from her for a while due to exhaustion, due to maybe an anxiety disorder that she developed, overworking and undersleeping and not taking care of herself physically as well as mentally. And she winds up in the hospital as a result. Now, they said she'd been in the hospital. The term a week or two had been, or like 2 weeks had been thrown around. So you're not really sure how long she was actually in there. But we know it's probably at least a week. And she's in the hospital, and she starts having these nightmares. Now, the episode goes on into the second act, where we meet her manager, named Barney, who, if she'd been in the hospital a week or two at this point, he had yet to come see her. And she comes at him pretty hard with the insults and the jabs as to why he hadn't seen her. He makes the excuse of he doesn't like hospitals. But of course, at this time, the doctor is still trying to figure out what's wrong with her, because physically there's really nothing wrong with her other than just being fatigued. But of course, he's not a psychiatrist. He's just a doctor who can only treat the body. He can't necessarily treat the mind unless he gives her, like they did back in the old days, the proper sedative. So Liz Powell is having these nightmares. And so in the second act, the doctor comes up with the idea of, hey, let's change things up a little bit. You say it always happens in this exact same order, with the clock ticking, the glass breaking, so on and so forth, down to the morgue, room for one more, screaming, crying, running away. He said, tonight, when you go to sleep, change the pattern. See if you can change the pattern. Don't reach for the glass of water, you know, or something like that. Try to change the pattern of the dream. So she does, and as a side note, it said that she was a dancer, and yet Barney referred to her as a stripper, and the fact that Barney is her manager, I don't know if I have anybody that's listening to this episode that may perhaps be an exotic dancer or a burlesque performer. If you are, I didn't know you guys had management, honestly. I thought it was, more of a 1099 thing. That's insane. I figured you were your own management if you were an exotic dancer or a burlesque performer. It's kind of the same vein because, in doing comedy, I know that, I know some burlesque performers, and I even know some exotic dancers, and all of them are just like comedy, just like anything else. You know, unless you reach a certain level, you're on your own as far as figuring it all out, with the business side and getting booked on shows and or perhaps in clubs, if you're a dancer, etc. So I can't, you know, especially in 1961, there's a stripper with a manager, and this seems kind of weird to me, unless this guy was just straight up taking advantage of her for money, which he may well have been doing. I don't know. But hearing the term stripper and manager in the same sentence just seemed a little interesting to me. The fact that you know, a stripper has a manager. Or I should say an exotic dancer, since stripper seems kind of almost a dirty word in a way. But, I mean, I could understand if you're perhaps like a big name in the like adult entertainment industry or something, and you do dancing on the side to make some money, I could understand maybe having some management then. But I couldn't see just a regular, just a regular exotic dancer needing management. So, if anyone out there knows anything about that, write me an email, dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. That just seems weird to me. And interesting. Or if anyone has any insight in that, email me, let me know. That just seemed weird to me that she would be an exotic dancer and have management. That just seemed a little off kilter to me, but what do I know? I wasn't alive then. That may have been the way things were done back then, maybe due to obscenity laws or something. I'm not sure. But here we are. Sorry to go off on that tangent. So, back to the story. Miss Liz Powell decides to try to break the routine per her doctor's request to see if anything is different or anything else crazy happens. And she wakes up. She hears the clock ticking. She tries to go to reach for the glass of water and then realizes, wait, nope, I'm not going to do that. So instead she reaches for a cigarette and she lights the cigarette and she hears the nurse, and in her haste to do something, she knocks over the glass of water, dropping it to the floor and shattering it, much like every other dream. She goes out to the hallway, goes down the hallway to the elevator, down to the basement, room 22, room for one more, honey, screaming, crying, running away, and waking up. So she tries alternating the pattern, altering the dream, and it does no good. It simply has a self-correcting system in place to where the events still happen, maybe not necessarily in the same order, but they still happen regardless. So the pattern of the dream cannot be changed. And the doctor, when he goes to out in the hall, he goes and tells the nurse that, you know, since no one's allowed in the basement except except hospital personnel, how would she know that room 22 is the morgue? And they go so far as to even bring up the woman who works the night shift in the morgue, who is also a nice-looking woman, similar characteristics, but not as striking or not as strong-featured, but same color hair, etc., etc., but not the same woman that was in Liz's dreams. So, after she's done having the dreams, the doctor can't figure out how she knows how room 22 is the morgue, and we know that the woman that runs the morgue on the second shift, or on the night shift, whatever, what have you, is not the same woman that Liz sees in her dreams. They decide that they've done all they can for her physically, and so they decide to release her. And so her manager, Barney, has her booked in Miami Beach to do some more dancing. And so he comes to collect her from the hospital, where the doctor says something to me a little creepy, where he says, you know, I plan to come see you someday, and if I do, just give me a little wink and a nod. Which would seem kind of weird to me. I don't know why, but that just seemed a little odd. But what have you. So Liz gets cleared to go. She gets released from the hospital, where she is going to go get on a plane. We get the feeling that Barney has already gone on ahead of her, gotten on the plane. She goes to the ticket counter. The man stamps her ticket, says, you know, your flight leaves through this door here onto the tarmac. And she goes walking through the airport to go to her door to get on the tarmac to board her plane. And she can hear a clock ticking really loudly. And then as she's walking to the door, she bumps a woman carrying a vase, and the vase drops and shatters, almost like a glass off of a table. And then she walks out the door, like she does of her room, onto the tarmac, down the carpet, like a hallway, to the steps of the plane, like the elevator. She walks up the steps, and a very striking woman with strong features meets her at the door, looks at her, and says, "Room for one more, honey." This causes Liz to scream and run away in fright and anxiety and everything else, and she stumbles and falls, making her way down the stairs, and she runs away screaming into the airport, where she is met in her fit of hysteria by airport personnel, who start to tend to her. And she goes to the window and watches the plane as it starts to take off, and the plane erupts into flames, presumably killing everyone on board. And that's when we get Rod's closing narration. Miss Elizabeth Powell, professional dancer. Hospital diagnosis: acute anxiety brought on by overwork and fatigue. Prognosis: with rest and care, she'll probably recover. But the cure to some nightmares is not to be found in known medical journals. You look for it under potions for bad dreams. To be found in the Twilight Zone. So, the fourth of six episodes to be filmed, shot on videotape instead of film, which I love. I actually love the episodes that were shot on videotape instead of film, and especially in this instance with this episode, it adds an ethereal sort of eerie quality to what is a story that I think a lot of people can relate to. And ultimately, the idea of the story is that someone has a premonition or a thought or a feeling that something's going to happen, and they change their ways accordingly, thereby averting disaster from befalling them. And this is a thing I think most people can say at some point in time in their life that they have. I know I certainly have. When I was a child, I was in a situation where something told me to extricate myself from that situation, and I did, and had I not, I certainly would have been seriously injured, if not killed, in the process. And if you look through history, if you look through anything else, look at 9/11. How many stories did you see come out after 9/11 where people had tickets to Flight 93 or one of the other flights where they decided at the last minute to not go, or something told them to not get on the plane, and so they didn't get on the plane, and by doing that, they didn't crash into the towers or into a field in Pennsylvania. You see, it's a funny thing. We're in the fifth dimension, and we're talking about the sixth sense, And that sixth sense to me is intuition. And everyone's got it. It's the same as when you were in school, and if you had a I had a teacher tell me, and I'm sure everyone has, had a teacher that told me one time that if you're taking a test and you don't outright know the answer to one of the questions, read the answers, you know, if it's a multiple choice, or think about it briefly and go with your gut instinct. If your gut instinct says it's C, go with C. You're probably going to be wrong about 25% of the time, maybe 30%, but you're going to be right way more than you're going to be wrong, because your body and your mind and your spirit, perhaps, knows more. You see, and that's the thing with this episode, and that I think a lot of people, and what makes it eerie, and what makes it, I think, a little more spooky or a little more unnerving or unsettling than other episodes of The Twilight Zone, is that everyone's had something like this happen to them. You may not know you have, but you have. You may normally take a certain route home when you drive home from work, and maybe one night you decide to go a different way just for no reason whatsoever. Maybe you want to see different scenery on your drive home, but you go a different way, and maybe there's a 10-car pileup if you would have went the other way. Or maybe a sinkhole opened up in the road and swallowed up 8 cars. You see, there's things we don't know in this world. And intuition is one of those things. We don't know why people think how they think or do what they do, or have the visions or ideas or thoughts that they have that work in situations like this. Call it intuition. That's what I call it. And that's certainly what I think it is. And everyone's got it. So that's why this episode to me is a little bit different, a little bit creepier, a little bit more intriguing and special. Because it's almost a universal sort of idea. Something tells you not to do something, and you do it, or you don't do it, and it was the best thing you could have done, is not doing it. Everyone's got that story. You may not think you do, but you do. If you think hard enough, you know you have that story. And that's, to me, what makes this episode a very special one. Just because of that. And because it's one of the ones shot on videotape, and I love those. I think they're a little bit spookier than the normal ones. And to me, a couple of good companion pieces to this episode, if you will, is Groundhog Day, the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray, about a repeating day over and over and over again. Or an episode in season one titled Perchance to Dream, which would be season one, episode 9, Perchance to Dream, about a man who hasn't dreamt in 4 days because he's been awake for 4 days because he knows if he dreams, he'll die. And the man in the episode actually dreams in sequence, dreams in basically episodes of a story. Much like the writer for that episode, Charles Beaumont, did in person when he was alive. And it's a very good episode, and if you haven't seen it or haven't listened to that episode of the podcast, go and listen to that at your leisure. I promise you won't be disappointed. So with that, let's get on to the bios. Now, this episode was directed by Jack Smite, who has directed 4 episodes of the Twilight Zone, and this would actually be the last of the episodes of the Twilight Zone that he directed. The first one was The Lonely, Season 1, Episode 7, with Jack Warden playing a convicted felon stuck on an asteroid who gets a robot girlfriend. Great episode. And the remainder of the episodes that Mr. Smite did were all in Season 2, and all of them, ending with this one, were the episodes shot on videotape. Lateness of the Hour, Night of the Meek, and finally, 22. So if you want to listen to his biography, go back and listen to The Lonely, Season 1, Episode 7. It's a great episode, and you'll learn about Jack Smite. Now, let's move on then to the star of the show, the woman with the golden lungs, the woman who played Miss Powell, Liz Powell, Miss Barbara Nichols. Now, Barbara Nichols was born in 1928, and she passed away at the age of 47 in 1976. Now, Miss Nichols was the typical bosomy, brassy blonde with the attitude to match, who was born in 1928 in Queens and basically grew up on Long Island. She was a redhead by birth, but after graduating from high school, she changed her reddish hair to platinum blonde and went into being a model and a burlesque dancer. So see, it all comes back around. She was a burlesque dancer. Also a beauty contestant. She won Miss Long Island, as well as the crown of Miss Dill Pickle and Miss Mink of 1953, as well as Miss Welder of 1953. She also became a GI pinup girl favorite. Not necessarily leading lady material, she found herself in small bit roles, managing to still somehow stand out while playing them. She did seem sort of typecast to be strippers, gold diggers, barflies, gun malls, and the floozy types. So like anyone who wanted to actually give it a go, she leaned into it and did the best she could, given the pigeonholing and typecasting that Hollywood was doing to her. Of course, most roles usually emphasized her physical endowments, but she had quite a sense for comedic timing. And with her timing and her shapely figure and her platinum blonde hair and her ability to crack wise, she landed a great year in 1957, landing roles in Pal Joey, The Sweet Smell of Success, and The Pajama Game. Of course, all in 1957. However, by the time 1960 rolled around, her film career had basically dried up, and she started to turn more toward television, appearing in such shows as The Beverly Hillbillies, Adam 12, of course, The Twilight Zone, The Untouchables, and the 1960s Adam West Batman. She found a little bit of success in Broadway with the musical Let It Ride in 1961, and even when it was able to appear in a couple of low-budget movies from time to time, including the campy prison drama House of Women in 1962 and the science fiction film Human Duplicators in 1965, starring George Nader and Richard Kiel, who, as you may know, played Jaws in the James Bond film, and also played Happy Gilmore's boss, former boss at the construction site, on Happy Gilmore with Adam Sandler. Unfortunately, in 1957, the year that she had her big year of a string of three movies that garnered some attention, she was in a serious car accident on Long Island, which led to the loss of her spleen. And then in the mid-60s, another serious car accident in Southern California led to a torn liver. Complications with these would set in, and a decade later, she would be forced to slow down her career, eventually developing a life-threatening liver disease, and her health deteriorated. By summer of 1976, she was taken into Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, where she went into a coma. She awoke for only a few days just before Labor Day, but sank back shortly thereafter and died at the age of 47 of liver failure. So much in the same way that we saw Mr. Dick York's rise and fall due to health complications, certainly Barbara Nichols was also unfortunately due to some accidents given to a shorter lifespan due to complications of those injuries. And it's a sad thing. 47 is way too young. Now let's move on to the doctor, played by Jonathan Harris. Jonathan Harris was born November 6th of 1914 and passed away about 22 years ago, the age of 87, in 2002. Now, he was in two episodes of The Twilight Zone. He was in this one, and he was also in season two a little further down the line in the episode The Silence, which is a fantastic episode. I can't wait to get to that one. Now, Mr. Harris was the son of Russian-Jewish immigrants and born in 1914. His father worked in the garment industry, and Jonathan, after school, would work as a box boy in a pharmacy, which sort of inspired him to, after graduating from high school, earn a pharmacy degree at Fordham University in 1936. However, he had a strong desire to act, and this caused him to quit what could have been a promising pharmaceutical career for unsteady theater work in New York. He watched English movies to help him shake his Bronx accent, which he did well to shake it, and took to the stage to act, performing in over 100 plays and stock companies nationwide. Finally made it onto Broadway in 1942 in Heart of the City. He also entertained troops during World War II in the South Pacific as part of the entertainment of the entertainment portion of the military. His fame on the stage led him to Hollywood to start acting in television in such anthology series as the Chevrolet Teletheater, Pulitzer Prize Playhouse, Betty Crocker Star Matinee, Goodyear Playhouse, and Hallmark Hall of Fame. His prowess for television was what kept him working throughout most of the 50s and into the 60s, starring in or having parts in the Armstrong Circle Theater, Studio One in Hollywood, Schlitz Playhouse, Climax, Colgate Theater, Kraft Theater, General Electric Theater. Stop me if you've heard these. He also began appearing on more popular television shows such as Zorro, Father's Knows Best, The Law and Mr. Jones, of course, The Twilight Zone, The Lloyd Bridges Show, and Bonanza. He finally got a little bit of recognition and success as audiences got to see him in the crime drama The Third Man, where he played cowardly assistant Bradley Webster, and also as hotel manager Mr. Phillips on the short-lived sitcom The Bill Dana Show, starring Bill Dana, the Latin-speaking comic, as a bellhop. All of this led him to the part of his career that he will always be most known for, and that would be Dr. Zachary Smith from Lost in Space. Because of this, he would find himself severely typecast as the villain for the rest of his career, which led him to other guest starring roles in television shows like The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, Land of the Giants, Get Smart, Bewitched, McMillan and Wife, Night Gallery, Sanford and Son, Fantasy Island, etc., etc. This led his career into the third act of his life, where he would do voiceovers for commercials and animated series, such as The Banana Splits Adventure Hour, Battlestar Galactica, The Twisted Tales of Felix the Cat, Buzz Lightyear of Star Command, and also the animated features Happily Ever After, A Bug's Life, and Toy Story 2. In his later years, he became a drama teacher and vocal coach, and sadly, 3 days before his 88th birthday, died when a blood clot made its way to his heart and killed him on November 3rd, 2002. And he was survived by his wife, whom he married in 1938, and his son, who was born in 1942. So he had a long and very busy career. Now, Barney, the manager, was played by Fred Wayne, who was born on October 17th, 1924, and passed away in 2018 at the age of 93. He was in two episodes of The Twilight Zone, 22, and season 3's The Arrival, and we'll get to that one in due time. He's got 131 IMDb credits, which means he was fairly busy for his career. Fred briefly worked as a delivery boy at Warner Brothers before being called up to military service during World War II. Being appointed a special service NCO, he was put in charge of providing entertainment for the troops as a writer, producer, and actor of Army productions. After the war, he got a job working at JCPenney's department store in New York while also taking drama classes at night at the American Theater Wing, along with fellow alumni Lee Marvin, Martin Balsam, and James Whitmore, all of whom are or will be on episodes of The Twilight Zone that we haven't covered yet. His breakout Broadway role came as Brewster Ames II in the musical comedy Texas Little Darlin'. From there, he went on to appear once more on Broadway in the 1951 satirical play Not for Children, written by Elmer Rice, and also in the London Theatre Royal cast of South Pacific as the comic relief character Luther Billis. Regularly on television in the 50s, beginning with anthology dramas, he became quite known across all genres, including The Twilight Zone, Perry Mason, 77 Sunset Strip, Have Gun Will Travel, The Rockford Files, which if you've seen The Rockford Files, you've seen this man, but you just don't know it. And Simon and Simon. However, one of his passions was bringing Benjamin Franklin to life on stage as he guested in a fondly remembered two-part installment of Bewitched, and also appearing in Go Fly a Kite at Aldo Tamberlin's Gate Theater in New York, and toured nationwide and internationally with his painstakingly researched and hugely successful one-man stage show that he also wrote, produced, and directed. He died, again, at the age of 93 in 2018. His last role being that of a doctor on the 1999 movie Man on the Moon, starring Jim Carrey, playing Andy Kaufman. And then lastly but not leastly, we got Arlene Martel, who was actually credited in this episode back then as Arlene Sachs, who was born April 14th, 1936, and passed away 10 years ago on August 12th, 2014, at the young age of 78. Now, she was born 1936 in New York City in the Bronx when her mother's boss saw the poor living conditions that she was living in. He personally underwrote her attendance at a boarding school in Connecticut. At the age of 12, Arlene assumed personal responsibility to audition for New York's famed High School of the Performing Arts. She gained entrance as well as went on to excel at the school, graduating with the school's top drama award. Her professional career began in her teens when she landed the role of Esther in the Broadway production of Uncle Willie, starring Norman Fell, who you might know from a little television series called Three's Company. This gave her the push she needed to head to Hollywood and began making guest appearances on TV shows such as The Untouchables, Route 66, The Twilight Zone, of course, where she was in two episodes. She was in, of course, this episode, 22, but she was also in Season 1, Episode 12's What You Need, about the old man that would sell people or give people what they need, almost like a soothsayer or fortune teller, almost. She played the woman who the old man gave the spot remover to, who wound up with the baseball player that was going to Scranton to coach a minor league baseball team. If you haven't seen that episode or listened to this episode of the podcast, or that episode of the podcast, please do so. I think you'll enjoy it. It's a great little episode. She did have a recurring role of Tiger on the sitcom Hogan's Heroes in 1965. Her ability to do accents and dialects enabled her to play a wide variety of characters, earning her the nickname The Chameleon. Arlene's relationship with famed actor James Dean is chronicled in Joe Hyam's biography, The James Dean Story. Married and divorced three times, Arlene had three children, and she died at the age of 78 of a heart attack in 2014. And her role that she is most remembered for is playing that of Spock's Vulcan bride, T'Pring, on the 1967 episode of Star Trek titled Amok Time. So with that, let's get to the trivia. Arlene Martel, also known as Arlene Sachs, who played the nurse in the morgue that taunts Liz Fowle with the "room for one more, honey" line. In order to make her look more sinister, they used makeup to give her a somewhat demonic look, complete with the arched eyebrows that you'll notice. She would later use this same technique to play the role of T'Pring in Star Trek 1967 episode, where she was Spock's bride. This, of course, was the fourth of six episodes to be videotaped. In the last scene of the episode, where Barbara Nichols is running down the stairs of the plane to run back in the terminal after the stewardess said, "room for one more, honey," she accidentally fell when she was running down the stairs and back into the, onto the runway and into the terminal. She accidentally fell. That was not scripted. Although Jack Smite loved it and kept the shot in as the one that they used for the show. Now, I know what you're going to say. This is also part of the trivia. I know what you're going to say. Bill, I've seen this story before. Where have I seen this story? And I'll tell you where you've seen this story before. This episode was the impetus for the 2000 film Final Destination. Although we don't know if Death was petty and came back after Liz Fowle, after she didn't get on the plane, much like he did to the five or so kids that got off the plane before it exploded in Final Destination. This story was adapted by Rod Serling from a short anecdote in the 1944 Bennett Cerf Random House anthology, Famous Ghost Stories, which itself was an adaptation of The Bus Conductor, a short story by E.F. Benson. The Bus Conductor is also the inspiration for one of the segments in the anthology horror film Dead of Night in 1945. The stuffed tiger that Liz clutches evoked the Barbara Graham character played by Susan Hayward in the 1958 film I Want to Live, about a woman executed in 1955 for a brutal robbery. And, of course, people of that time would remember, might remember that when they watched this episode live in 1961. And Wesley Lau, who played the airline agent at the ticket counter, who assisted Miss Powell to get her boarding pass, played Lieutenant Anderson in 81 episodes of Perry Mason. Now, with that, let's move to the goofs. When Liz first faces the elevator, a profile shot reveals her hands. Her hand is by her by the side of her face, but a front view shows her hand has moved. And during Rod Serling's plug for the following week's show, which if you had the Blu-rays, at the end of every episode, you see Rod's plug for the following week's episode. But during Rod Serling's plug for the following week's show, the middle section had clearly been dubbed. Now, likes and dislikes. I like this episode. I like the fact that it was one of the ones shot on videotape. To me, it made it more eerie, more ominous, more scary, and more fun. I really like Barbara Nichols. As a side note, she was absolutely beautiful woman. Very, very striking woman. So was Arlene Martel, for that matter. And I always thought it weird that she was dressed in a nightgown and not like one of those, you know, hospital issue, gowns that they give you. But I suppose we really couldn't have, Barbara Nichols running down the hallway with her derriere, sticking out for the world to see, I suppose. That would have made it a somewhat different episode, possibly. Not that I'm complaining, but I really like this episode. I like the videotape aspect of it. I liked Liz Powell's performance. She has a heck of a scream on her, that's for sure. Arlene Martel plays it creepy as all could be, and it works wonderfully. The doctor, for some reason, also plays as creepy as could humanly be, and he does quite well at it. The guy that played Barney played a very lovable sap, who you could tell was basically just in it for himself. So, everyone did a great job. Jack Smite's direction was very good. The cinematography, everything, lighting. I thought this was one of the best episodes so far of season two. And certainly, it's not my top five, not in my top 10, but I would say probably in my top 25 episodes of The Twilight Zone. It's a great show. It's a great episode. You should love it as much as I do. Now, I know, of course, some people are going to say, like, well, this episode sucks. I've only watched it once, and I hated it. I thought Barbara Nichols was horrible. I thought Arlene Martel looked like Rick Moranis. I don't care what you're going to say. You know, every man's monsters are due on Maple Street is another man's bewitching pool, and I understand that. You know. But here we are. So it's my opinion. Top 25 for me. Easily. This is a great episode. You should watch it. What didn't I like about it? What didn't I like about it? Really not much, honestly. There were some things that didn't make sense to me. Again, she could have been in a hospital-issued gown. I always thought it was weird that she was just in what essentially was a slip. Again, not that I'm complaining. But that was just kind of weird, especially if she'd been in there for a couple weeks. I don't know, it just seemed kind of odd to me. Also, I wish they could have done more with something, maybe bringing in some sort of psychiatrist to talk to her and maybe figure out something, or maybe add another layer to the story. I thought that would have been interesting, but I really can't fault this episode too much. It's quite well done, quite a good episode, and yeah, I really can't fault it too much. So with that, let's get on to the casting. So if Hollywood, the entity, were to call me and say, Bill, we're going to remake this episode, how would you cast it? And I would say, well, Hollywood, here's how I would cast it. For the role of Liz Powell, I would cast Hayden Panettiere. Now, I know what you're going to say, well, she was in Scream. She's already a Scream Queen. Yeah, that's why I would cast her. Because she's easy on the eyes. She can scream like nobody's business. And she's actually a pretty good actor. So I think all those three things together, throw her in a slip, slap her in a hospital bed, have her run down the hallway, and you can remake this episode all day long. All right. For her manager, Barney, I could think of no one else in the world, and prove me wrong by emailing me at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. Prove me wrong, but there's no one today that could play that role of Barney like Tom Arnold. And I dare you to prove me wrong. Prove me wrong. Send me an email. I'd love to read it. For the role of the doctor, I would go with everyone's favorite doctor, Hugh Laurie, who played Dr. House. I would put him as the doctor because he could play that sort of creepy, sort of almost maniacal kind of character that you don't really trust, but he's a doctor, so you kind of have to, sort of person. And I think Hugh Laurie would excel at that. And then lastly, but not leastly, who would I cast as the woman in the morgue / the flight attendant, the woman with the striking features, or the striking looks and strong features? Mila Kunis. I really don't see, to me, that's who I would pick. If you disagree, I would love to hear about it. If you agree, I would love to hear about it. Send me an email, dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. And with that, we'll move on to the moral and philosophy of the episode. I think the moral and the philosophy of this episode is quite simple. I believe it is all about trusting your instincts, as we kind of discussed earlier. It's all about going with your gut feeling. Liz Powell had a dream repeatedly, and her gut feeling, especially after seeing the stewardess, told her to get off that plane, don't get on that plane, get out of the way, go inside, stay away. And it turned out to be right as the plane exploded, presumably killing everyone on board. And I think it's a good lesson for all of us. Listen to your inner voice. Your inner voice knows things you don't. Like I said, you know, we're in the fifth dimension using our sixth sense. Use your sixth sense. You know what I mean? It's why it's there. That intuition is a powerful tool if you know how to use it and if you listen to it. So, listen to it. And with that, I think we can bring this episode in for a nice soft landing and not exploding on the tarmac. I hope you enjoyed it. I want to thank all 18 of you for listening. You people truly brighten my day, and it makes it worthwhile to sit here in this room and talk into this tin can for an hour each week. I am working on putting together a YouTube channel where I will be reviewing each episode of The Twilight Zone along with other things like movies and other, maybe some television shows of other things. But I will have more on that as it progresses. I'll keep you informed. And hopefully you and 99,999 of your closest friends can come visit and hit the like and subscribe button. And while you're at it, whatever you're listening to this episode on, hit the like and subscribe if that's even a thing. I don't even know, to be honest with you. But I appreciate you listening, even if you don't. Now, stay tuned for next week's episode, where we have a plane full of people that go back in time to a Manhattan where there's no traffic. So stay tuned for the Odyssey of Flight 33 coming up next week on Dimensions Twilight Zone Podcast. Thank you for listening, and good night.